It's time to turn to the WUKY Sports page with your host, Keith Elkins, revealing conversations and stories you thought you knew from prominent Kentucky sports figures. Now, here once again is Keith Elkins.
Dan Issel's basketball career at Kentucky and in the professional ranks has placed him in numerous halls of fame, including the Naismith Memorial Basketball Hall of Fame, the College Basketball Hall of Fame, the UK Athletics Hall of Fame, Kentucky Sports Hall of Fame, Colorado Sports Hall of Fame, and others. He scored 2,138 points in three seasons at Kentucky, averaging just under 26 points a game for his career. That's a record that has stood for 50 years now. He went on to play professionally with the Kentucky Colonels in the ABA and the Denver Nuggets of the NBA. He was an all-star in both leagues, and at the time of his retirement as a player in 1985, only Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Wilt Chamberlain, and Julius Erving had scored more points as a professional player. He's been an NBA coach and executive and is currently president of the NBA to Louisville Initiative, an effort to bring NBA basketball to Louisville. There are many other SEC and All-American credentials I could cite, but we'll stop there for now, Dan, and just say welcome. Good to have you with us.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be here. You read all of that stuff off, it proves one thing: I'm really old.
Well, I guess it has been a few years since I listened to you in high school, listened to Kaywood call your games in high school, and of course, like many other people who have followed Kentucky, really enjoyed your time at Kentucky and then on in the pros and the long career in the pros and since basketball. So we're certainly glad to have you on as a guest. Let's talk a little bit about what you're doing currently before we go down memory lane a little bit. You've been at the front in the movement to bring NBA basketball to the city of Louisville. And as with everything else, the pandemic kind of places things on hold. What's the latest you can tell us on that?
Well, I spoke with the commissioner just a couple of weeks ago, and for years, their position has been expansion isn't on the table. But because of this pandemic and the owners losing about 40% of their revenue because of no fans in the stands, it has crept into the conversation. There are some owners, especially the ones in the hospitality industry, who aren't doing well, and so there's a possibility that expansion could be discussed. And of course, if it does, there's going to be a lot of competition for what we think will probably be two additional teams. But we think we can make a pretty compelling argument that Louisville and Kentucky ought to be considered.
Well, it's certainly appropriate for many reasons that you would be part of the effort to bring the NBA to Louisville, and you played in Louisville for the Kentucky Colonels of the ABA, and the ABA had been in existence for a couple of seasons at the time you finished at UK. Before we get into your UK playing days, tell me about how that opportunity with the Colonels and the ABA developed as your college career came to an end.
Well, it was about that time. The ABA had gotten serious about signing some of the better college players. In fact, my senior year, the consensus All-American team was Pete Maravich, Charlie Scott, Rick Mount, myself, Bob Lanier, and Calvin Murphy, and three of us went to the ABA, and three went to the NBA. And, of course, about that time also, the ABA started signing underclassmen, which the NBA didn't do at that point. And so I had become pretty good friends with Louis Dampier, and he was playing with the Colonels, and I'd fallen in love with the state. So when I was informed that the Colonels had my draft rights, staying in Kentucky to further my career was a pretty easy choice.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's no question about the talent that was in the ABA. The Colonels, of course, were very well supported by the fans. There was a lot of radio and TV coverage. Some of the other franchises were very strong. Others, not so much. I think of teams like the Pittsburgh Condors and the Anaheim Amigos and the Miami Floridians. Any memories that would illustrate what it was like playing in those places as opposed to playing in a place like Louisville where there was great interest in basketball?
Yeah. It was about 50-50. There were some solid franchises like Denver, like Indianapolis, like Louisville with the Colonels. But you're right. There were some that had a hard time paying their bills. I can remember one occasion when the last year of the ABA, I was playing for the Nuggets in Denver, and the Virginia Squires came to town, and the hotel wouldn't let them check in because they hadn't paid their bill from the last day. And so they were standing out on the sidewalk in front of the hotel with their luggage, and Carl Scheer, who was the president and general manager of the Nuggets, had to go down and pay both bills so that the Squires could check into the hotel.
Well, it was an interesting time, and certainly a colorful story as far as the ABA history is concerned. Fans who may not know, of course, the ABA had the red, white, and blue basketball and the three-point shot, which was a real innovation in that time as well. It was really fun to watch.
It really was, and in at that time in history, the NBA was kind of a walk the ball up the floor and try to pound it inside to the big guys. And the ABA, I think, because of the 3-point play and because of the league initially anyway being really guard heavy. I mean, the Colonels had two of the best shooters I've ever seen in Louis Dampier and Daryl Carrier. The game was more wide open, and it was more entertaining. And I have very fond memories. The only championship I ever won in 25 years of organized basketball was the ABA championship in Louisville. And that's one of the reasons that I have thrown in with the initiative to bring a pro team here. To this day, I have men and women come up to me and say, we remember those Colonel days. My mother or my father or my grandpa used to take me to those Colonels games. And I'd like for some of the youngsters here in Kentucky to be able to experience that again, because a lot of fond memories of my Colonel days.
Well, it was a great period in basketball history, especially with you and Dampier leading the way as former Kentucky Stars on that team. Of course, Mike Pratt played for the Colonels as well. And I have a magazine that I bought, a Colonels magazine. I saw the Colonels play at you played a few games at Memorial Coliseum. And your teammates from the 73-74 season, as I look down the roster, Walt Simon, Joe Hamilton, Ron Thomas, Red Robbins, in addition to, of course, Louis Dampier and Artis Gilmore. But when you hear the names of these teammates, what does that bring back for you?
Yeah, about two-thirds of the players you just mentioned were on that championship team. The reason that we played some of those games in Memorial Coliseum was a tornado had taken the roof off of Freedom Hall in Louisville. Uh-huh. And so we didn't have a place to play, and so we did play some of our playoff games that year in Memorial Coliseum. But great. I have more friends to this day from my ABA days than I do from my NBA days. Louie and I are very close and see artists all the time. And unfortunately, a couple of our teammates have passed the last year or two. But that was my favorite team that I ever played on professionally.
You also had a chance to work under Frank Ramsey, speaking of Kentucky connections, and you mentioned him in your Hall of Fame acceptance speech as being someone who was very influential to your career as well.
He really was. Of course, you had, when you went into the Hall of Fame, you had to be presented, still do to this day, you have to be presented by a member of the Hall of Fame. And so having Frank present me at Springfield was a very easy choice. Funny story, Frank came in and coached my rookie year, and Coach Rupp called me and said, Frank's father owned about half of Madisonville, Kentucky, and I think Frank bought the other half. So he was a pretty successful businessman down there. And Coach Rupp called me right after Frank took the job, and he said, Frank's just having a little cash flow problem. He needs that job, but he'll be there 1 year. It doesn't matter if he's successful or if he's not successful, he'll do it for 1 year for the money, and then he'll go back to Madisonville. And sure enough, we were only a little over 500 during the regular season, but peaked at the right time and went to Game 7 of the ABA Championship that year against the Utah Stars. And Coach Rupp was 100% right. Frank said, thanks a lot. I enjoyed the year, and he went back to Madisonville. But, yeah, Frank, you know, that was my first year as a pro, and Frank had been a pro for many years with the Boston Celtics, and he really taught me, you know, some about basketball, but more importantly, how to conduct yourself as a professional player.
And speaking of that, you had one thread throughout your career was that your teammates, your coaches appreciated the way you went about your work as a professional basketball player. You played the game hard, and they appreciated that. You rarely missed a game, less than a couple dozen, I think, in all the years you played professional basketball. And there had to be nights when you weren't at 100%. What was behind that kind of motivation to be that kind of player?
Yeah, I think it was just my upbringing. My early days, I grew up on a farm in Missouri, and then we moved to Illinois. And my father was a blue collar worker, and instilled that work ethic in me. There were some nights I probably shouldn't have played because I wasn't feeling well or had an injury, but I always felt that if I didn't go out there and at least try, I was letting down my teammates and my coaches and more importantly the people who paid their money to come and see me play. So they weren't all great efforts, but at least I was out there trying and it's just that Midwest work ethic that a lot of kids grew up with.
Let me ask you one more question about your Colonels teammates. You mentioned getting to see them as frequently as you can. Is there any particular subject or story that comes up repeatedly comes up as one of your favorites when you get together with teammates? Anything that everybody likes to talk about every time you get together?
Well, yeah, and the farther we get from it, the better we all think we were. And so the conversation gets a little carried away at times, but I think the single most talk about topic is the championship. I think that we had the best team in the league just about every year that Artis was here. And, in fact, Artis's rookie year, my second year, our regular season record was 68-16. But we just, for some reason, we couldn't get over the hump. We kept losing in the playoffs. And finally, that 1975 championship, took the monkey off of our backs, and we proved that we really did have a good team. So I would say most of the conversation kind of leads toward that championship season and especially that championship series against the Indiana Pacers.
Mm-hmm. When you played at UK, and we'll go back to your Kentucky days now, did you realize as a player just how much the basketball program meant to fans around the state, or was that something that you gained appreciation for later? I mean, obviously there wasn't the kind of media that we have now, and not that many games were on television, but certainly every game was on radio, and that's the way Kentucky fans followed the game. But could you get that sense as a young man and as a player just how much it meant to the fans?
I didn't know when I first came here. I knew that Kentucky was a very successful program. I knew Coach Rupp's record over the years. I knew how many NCAA championships they'd won. So I knew it was a great program. I didn't know the support that fans give the program. It's just unbelievable. I've been around some pretty rabid fan bases, the Denver Bronco fans for one in Colorado, but I've never seen anything like Kentucky fans. And that's what makes it so special to play here. And I tell people that, you know, I played 25 years of organized basketball from seventh grade through 15 years as a pro. And my four favorite years were the 4 years I was in Lexington, because, you know, it was so much fun to play for that program and to play for those fans. And it's just incredible. I can walk down the street in Lexington or Louisville or Owensboro, and, you know, people talk to me like they saw me day before yesterday, and I played at Kentucky 50 years ago. So it's just incredible that how fans react to the people at the UK program.
What was the access to players at that time? Could a fan write a letter to you and have you receive it? Did you hear from fans in that way? Were there fan letters or other communication that you got from fans?
Yeah, there were letters, and you know, for the most part, people would just stand around after the game and ask for an autograph. I recall that every New Year's Eve we would play Notre Dame in Freedom Hall. Mm-hmm. And they would open, we would have a shoot around, a pregame practice around noon, 11 o'clock or noon, and they would open Freedom Hall for the fans just to come in and watch the shoot around. And there'd be 10 or 12,000 people at Freedom Hall, yes, before the game just to watch us shoot. And, you know, I remember that they would line up and ask for autographs, and it would take us a while to sign them all and get back on the bus. And I can remember Coach Rupp telling us one time, he said, "Don't you ever worry about people asking for your autograph." He said, "You worry when they stop asking." Mm-hmm. And so I always tried to, I always remember that and tried to, you know, to be available to fans to talk or sign something when they wanted me to.
Well, speaking of Coach Rupp, of course, you played for him at Kentucky. On his staff were a young Joe Hall and the veteran assistant Harry Lancaster. That was a pretty stern coaching staff, pretty challenging. What was that like playing for those guys?
Yeah, I tell people that there are two ways to motivate people. One is to pat them on the back, and the other one is to kick them in the tail. And Coach Rupp and Coach Lancaster's philosophy was kind of you kicked everybody, and if they weren't strong enough to take it, they didn't want you on their team. But I saw Coach Hall just the other day. He of course is in a nursing home, and I had to talk to him on the phone while looking through his window. But I owe a great deal to Coach Hall. I wasn't coming to Kentucky. I'd signed a Big Ten letter to go to Wisconsin, and Coach Hall spent about 3 or 4 days in my hometown. I had taken a recruiting trip to Kentucky, but I wasn't their first choice, wasn't even their second choice. They really wanted a player by the name of George Jahnke, who wound up signing with Dayton. Mm-hmm. And after that happened, Coach Hall came to Batavia and stayed until we agreed to take a second recruiting trip to come to Kentucky. And of course, that was the best decision I ever made. So I owe a great deal to Coach Hall and Coach Rupp. Playing for Coach Rupp, again, you go back to what we were talking about earlier with the work ethic and the blue collar approach to the game. He was a perfect coach for me, because, you know, if he thought I couldn't do something, then by gosh, I was going to show him I could. So it was a great coaching staff to play for.
It didn't take long after you became a varsity player that you became the focus of the team's offense. How did that work? Did Coach Rupp just say, "This is how it's going to be," or did it sort of evolve? And how do you think you handled that? And also, were your teammates good with that? How did the whole situation come about?
Yeah, it was, of course, my sophomore year, our sophomore year, the first year we were eligible because freshmen couldn't play then, Mike Casey from Shelby County was the best player on the floor. I think he led us in scoring a sophomore year, but then you know, my game started to improve, and Coach Rupp would run more plays where I was supposed to get the basketball. And then, of course, my senior year, Mike Casey had an automobile accident and missed the entire season. And so Mike Pratt and I were kind of the main offensive cogs. And so yeah, it was just, you know, Coach Rupp running the plays that the ball wound up in our hands. And thank goodness some of them went in.
You mentioned that college freshmen became eligible for were not eligible for varsity play at that time. They became eligible just a couple of years after you finished at UK. The expectations are so high for the college freshmen coming in now. When you were a freshman at UK, what do you think the challenges would have been for you in going against older players at that age? Because nowadays we expect these guys to develop just within weeks of the start of their freshman season.
Yeah, you know, it was much different then. You didn't play basketball year round. I didn't play on any teams other than my high school basketball team, and I went to a small high school and played football, basketball, baseball, and even high jumped. So it was it wasn't until my senior year that in high school that I concentrated only on basketball. But now today, you know, these kids play year round, and they're playing AAU ball and then playing high school ball, and they mature so much faster because they've had so much basketball that I don't think I wouldn't have been too good playing as a freshman on varsity. And I'm kind of happy the way it developed, because if I had played varsity my freshman year, I might have got left behind.
Well, your name has been connected with Pete Maravich all these years. Your career paralleled his at LSU, and Kentucky won every meeting with LSU in your three seasons. And, of course, there were some great scoring duels, a lot of great individual scorers at that time. No three-pointer, no shot clock, and Kentucky won 121-105 in his last home game, and he had 64. And you had 51 with 17 rebounds, and those are incredible numbers. But that's, in general, the way that series went, didn't it?
Yeah, and the reason it went that way was a lot of coaches in the SEC would try to devise ways to stop Pete. You know, they'd run the box in one, or a triangle in two, and try to take the ball out of Pete's hands. But he was so clever with the basketball that he, you know, you couldn't stop him. And so Coach Rupp's philosophy was, hey, we're going to guard him one-on-one. We'll let him get his points, because we can't keep him from getting them anyway. And we'll just make sure nobody else beats us. And so in the six games that we played head-to-head, I think Pete averaged 52 points and, as you said, got 64 one game. But the closest they ever came to beating us was 9 points. So Coach Rupp's philosophy worked pretty well. You know, his senior year, I tell people our senior year, I was second in the nation in scoring and only lost the scoring championship by 10 points a game. Pete averaged 44 points a game his senior year at LSU. Now, you talk about records never being broken. I think that's one that has a pretty good chance of standing.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever a moment on the court, or maybe even off the court, when you had a chance to talk with him and kind of compare notes? Not that you were similar kinds of players, but certainly great scorers and the featured weapons on your team. Did you ever have a chance to talk with him about that experience?
Oh yeah, well, we didn't talk about that, but Pete and I became pretty close friends. We went to our sophomore year. After our sophomore year, we went we went to the Olympic trials in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And so we were together for a week out there and hung out and got to know each other. And then after that, our junior and senior year, when he came to Lexington or I went to LSU, you know, we would might go out the night before a game. And so we got to be pretty good friends. And Pete was a pretty wild guy back in those days. But thank goodness he straightened out and was walking the straight and narrow when he unfortunately passed away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if anyone has not seen video of Pete Maravich, it is truly astonishing what he could do on a basketball court. You've mentioned your hometown.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say he's the best passer and basketball and handler of the basketball that I've ever seen. I mean, you talk about any of them, Magic Johnson, right down the line. Pete was unbelievable what he could do with a basketball.
You've mentioned your hometown of Batavia, Illinois, a couple of times. You grew up there with future Cincinnati Bengals quarterback Ken Anderson, and the sportscaster Craig Sager was just a couple of years behind you in school. Tell me about your experience and knowing those guys as you were growing up there in Batavia.
Yeah, it was kind of unbelievable. Kenny and I grew up, our backyards butted up against each other. And Kenny went on. He went to Augustana College on a part scholarship, academic scholarship, part basketball scholarship, and wound up playing 15 years in the NFL. And in addition to that, we had two brothers that in my class and a class ahead of me that wound up playing professional baseball. One of them made it to the major leagues for a couple of seasons. And we had a lady on the LPGA tour, all from a little town of 7,500 people. And I've known Craig Sager since grade school. He and my brother were actually best friends. And so Craig was always over the house. So it was pretty unbelievable for a little town like that to have that many people associated with professional sports.
It really is. A lot of times when young people become involved in sports and say they want to be a professional when they grow up, some adults like to discourage them by saying how long the odds are against them. But here you have guys like yourself and Ken Anderson and Craig Sager and others who have made it, and Batavia was not a very big place. So you really, really bucked the odds there.
And you know, it goes again. It goes back. Batavia was a blue collar town, and you know, people grew up not taking shortcuts and realizing the hard work it took to be successful at whatever you wanted to be successful at, and I think that showed.
Well, I did minor league baseball games on radio here in Lexington for 9 years, so I wanted to ask you a baseball question. Many fans may not know that you are a lifelong fan of the Chicago Cubs, growing up there in Illinois, and the rowdiest fans of the Cubs were known as the Bleacher Bums, and you may not have been a card-carrying Bleacher Bum member, but you spent some time in the bleachers at Wrigley Field, didn't you?
I sure did. I was lucky enough that my best friend growing up there in elementary school, his mother was a huge Cub fan, and 6, 7, 8 times a summer, she'd load 4 or 5 of us in the car, and we'd go to Wrigley Field and sit in the bleachers for $5. And in those days, it's hard to believe now, in those days, they only opened the upper deck on weekends for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday games. If you went during the week, they didn't even have enough fans to open up the upper deck. But I grew up, Ernie Banks was my hero, and I grew up thinking I was going to play shortstop for the Chicago Cubs. But it's been a long, frustrating following, but we finally won the championship 4 or 5 years ago, so I can go peacefully now, knowing the Cubs won the World Series.
I was going to say, as a fan, I guess that's got to be your number one championship, ranking behind your championship as a player with the Cardinals. But as a fan, the Cubs Cubs World Series victory has to be right up there.
It certainly was, and we went. I didn't get to go to any of the games when in the World Series, but I've been in Wrigley Field for some of the playoff series prior to that, and again, it was always frustration. But you know, to finally win it, it almost made it worth all those years. Mm-hmm.
Did you ever get to meet Ernie Banks or get an autograph?
You know what? I never did. I did get to meet some of the Cubs, Ryan Sandberg, for instance. In fact, my one of my grandson's middle name is Ryan, named after Sandberg, and he was nice enough to give us a signed jersey for our grandson Brody. But I got to meet a few of the Cubs, but I never did get to meet Ernie.
Well, Dan, what is ahead for you now? You're staying very active, of course, with the NBA to Louisville initiative, and I know you'll be busy with that and probably out ready to meet some people as soon as we can all start going to public events again. But what's ahead for you?
Yeah, that that's the focus, and I was doing a lot of speaking engagements and a lot of events around NBA to Lou. And of course, that is all slowed down. So hopefully we'll get this pandemic behind us and we can go back to work. I do have I have five grandchildren in Colorado. So, one of these days we'll call it quits and retire to Colorado and watch them grow up. But I'm a pretty competitive person. And so you can only watch so many Judge Judy's and Price is Right. So I'm not ready to call it quits yet.
Got to have a plan for retirement, don't you?
Exactly.
Well, Dan, I appreciate you taking time today to reminisce a little bit and also to look ahead with the NBA to Louisville initiative. And we appreciate your time. Thanks for being on with us.
Always a pleasure. Anytime.
You've been listening to The Sports Page with Keith Elkins, an exclusive podcast from 91.3 WUKY, produced by Alan Lytle. Our theme music is Peanut Butter and Jam by Illogical Bit, available at soundcloud.com/illogicalbit. Subscribe to The Sports Page through Google Play or at our website, wuky.org.